everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up in today's show, Lucy Foley takes us to the wilds of Scotland with her brand new thriller, The Hunting Party.
We were told beforehand that in the event of very heavy snowfall, we might not be able to get into the estate and we might not be able to get out if we were already there. And that got me thinking, this is sort of perfect kind of murder mystery setting.
Guy Kenaway discusses assisted dying in his forthcoming memoir, Time to Go.
Will you please give me a hand? I don't want to either go into a care home or slip into dementia, and I want to take control over, you know, the place and the manner and the timing of my own death.
And we say farewell to June Whitfield and look back at her contribution to the RNIB library.
He called my bluff. He took the eye out himself, hopped out of the bath and chased me around the bathroom with it. Serve me right.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Lucy Foley's debut novel, The Book of Lost and Found, established her as a best-selling author of historical fiction. Her next two books confirmed this, but her latest, The Hunting Party, is a tense, contemporary thriller. Set over New Year 2019, it transports the reader to a remote hunting lodge in the Scottish Highlands, where a group of high-flying 30-somethings has gathered to relive their glory days at Oxford University. But when one of them is found dead on New Year's morning, the remaining members of the party, along with the housekeeper and the gamekeeper, must come to terms with the fact that there's a murderer among them. Lucy Foley, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So the part of the Highlands that you write about, the wilderness where the hunting party goes for New Year, feels very, very real. Was it inspired by a place that you'd actually visited yourself?
It actually was. So my husband and I, we'd actually travelled to this place that it is very closely based on a couple of times before. And we travelled up there in the middle of winter one year. And I saw it in a completely different way. We were told beforehand that in the event of very heavy snowfall, we might not be able to get into the estate and we might not be able to get out if we were already there. And that got me thinking, this is sort of perfect kind of murder mystery setting.
And the hunting lodge where all the characters gather is a very isolated place. But you also deal with isolation in other forms, isolation within relationships and characters who feel that they are isolated from the rest of humanity. Was that something that you really wanted to explore more deeply?
I think it absolutely was, although I perhaps hadn't realised the extent to which I'd done that. And actually a very perceptive reader said to me the other day, all of the characters in the book are outsiders, in a sense. So every one of them in their own way. But thinking about it, I think that's very much the case. And I think, you know, that was where I started the book, actually thinking about these characters and why you would want to go and live on a kind of very remote estate, really cut off from the rest of humanity. So I probably found writing Doug, the gamekeeper, and Heather, the manager's, part's most interesting in that sense, I think.
Yes, and whereas the party that comes up from London sees the beauty in the wilderness, they, Doug and Heather, actually see the savagery in that beauty, don't they?
Absolutely. Nature red in tooth and claw, you know, and they know the dangers that sort of surround these guests, and they sort of have to kind of wrap these guests in cotton wool in a way, even though the guests don't realise this. But I think what I also loved writing was this sort of scene where the guests start realising that they are kind of separated from their kind of mod con. So they realise that there's sort of no phone signal on the estate and the Wi-Fi has to actually be turned on if they want it. And that perhaps starts to kind of unleash something in them, something kind of latent and feral, I think.
Yes, you're always talking about the lizard brain or the...
Yes, the amygdala.
Yes. beware what gets unleashed when your sense of entitlement is thwarted.
Absolutely.
And I wondered if you'd also been on one of those annual regathering parties where you did meet up with friends from university who maybe the friendship wasn't quite as tight as it had been 10 years beforehand.
Definitely, I have to be really careful what I say here, but I have certainly had experiences like that. And I think New Year's Eve is a really funny time. You know, everyone feels like they should be doing something. They should be kind of at a wild party. It can probably make you agree to things that you wouldn't otherwise agree to, and to catch ups with people that you maybe haven't seen for a long time, and probably perhaps with good reason. So it was sort of inspired by those two things, I think, that came together in this rather dark way.
I love the way that you describe the pressures of old established friendships and how there are expectations of how you're going to behave amongst each other, even if maybe, well, I think you use the lovely expression, it's a regathering of threads that have grown a bit looser over the years.
Definitely. Definitely. I think there's this sort of really, you know, you have to be really sort of proactive about it when you meet up with old friends. You do have to sort of, you have to find those things that united you and sort of dredge them up maybe from history. And sometimes in the best way, it's a wonderful kind of nostalgic process. But I think also it can sometimes highlight to you the fact that perhaps you don't have quite so much in common as you thought you did anymore.
The group of friends who gather in the story are, you use the expression, that they've led charmed lives. So they are the bright young things of 10 years before, and they have a real sense of entitlement. They're actually really not a particularly nice bunch, and I get the impression that you quite enjoy skewering them in the writing, rather like Evelyn Waugh did in his early novels.
Absolutely. I love that comparison to Evelyn Waugh. I'll take that, thank you. And I think that's also something that obviously the queen of kind of golden age crime, Agatha Christie, does so well. They are characters that you love to hate, and I probably enjoyed writing them more than I should have done. You want to write characters that are kind of compellingly awful. You don't want them to be boring in their awfulness. And in a way, I try to give some of them something not sympathetic about their characters, but something that, you know, the reader could kind of latch onto. But they are, in their different ways, all pretty awful. Apart from Heather, the manager of the estate, and Doug, the groundskeeper. Hopefully you feel that.
Yes, and the perspective that we get from their narrative voices is vital to the book. It's the reality, as opposed to the sort of the shimmer and glitter of the bright young things who've come up determined that they're going to impose their urban ways on this remote landscape.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I love about the kind of the Agatha Christie style murder mystery is that sort of upstairs, downstairs thing. And I was kind of looking for a way to do that in a modern setting. And I thought the way to do that is to have these very entitled, kind of moneyed, spoiled Londoners coming up and splashing their cash around. And so that's sort of how that worked.
You're one of the bright young things of historical fiction. You've certainly made your name with your first three novels as a writer of historical fiction. What led you to start writing thrillers?
It's a funny thing. So I read very widely, and I came to writing as a reader. And when I wrote my first book, The Book of Lost and Found, it was very much because that was the book that I wanted to read. And so that's how I've always approached my writing. And I had started to think, I really want to read a modern kind of take on the Golden Age murder mystery. That's what led me to start thinking, I want to write this sort of book. I then needed the setting, I needed the plot. And that was where this experience on this Snowdon Scottish estate came in.
You mentioned Golden Age writers such as Agatha Christie. It also called to mind for me Barbara Vine, Ruth Rendell.
I love Ruth Rendell, absolutely.
Yeah, her psychological thrillers, sort of putting a group of people in an isolated spot and turning up the pressure and seeing what blows.
Definitely. And I think Dorothy Sayers as well. Gosh, I've been reading another one recently and I now can't remember the name of the author, but it is from that. I think the wonderful thing is there, all the publishers seem to be sort of unearthing their kind of their golden age murder mystery writers and sort of repackaging them. And it's brilliant because I've discovered so many what would have been forgotten names through that.
The book was published first at the end of last year in audio and is now out in hardback, which, for those of us who rely on audio as our access to books, is fantastic news. Was that a conscious decision on your behalf?
To publish the audiobook first? Mm. Yeah, I think from the publishers, they just thought they were so excited about the audiobook and this wonderful cast they had lined up for it. I think they thought this is a wonderful way to get people really excited about the book, to kind of share clips of that audiobook online, to have those characters brought to life. So it's something I was really excited about.
Well, for me, it was terrific. I actually felt I was reading it in real time. It starts just before New Year's Eve and ends on New Year's Day. And it actually felt like I was living it. It was rather good. I felt we'd got the drop on the print readers, being given the exclusive beforehand.
Absolutely. And it's funny, I mean, I probably, half of the books that I read, I listen to an audiobook. So it was really exciting for me to have that.
You say you're a voracious reader. Do you read all genres, or do you get stuck into crime fiction and find that you've read nothing else for a couple of months?
So both, I would say, because I read very widely. I would say I read across genres. And I think that's sometimes a thing that writing books, and also having worked in the publishing industry, which I did, you can almost get hung up on genre. And actually, people just want a really good read. But I would say that I also get obsessive. So I'll discover a particular author or a particular style of a book that I'm really enjoying, and I will read that for a few months, and then I need to kind of jolt myself out of it. So a bit of both.
And did you have much to do with picking the narrators for the audiobook? I should say there are five narrators, because the story is told from five different points of view, and it's quite a stellar cast.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was really excited about it. I think I'm definitely going to have to write books with a cast of characters from now on, so I get a lovely kind of cast of narrators. So it was really exciting, and they sent me, I think I had sort of five different options for each narrator, and it was really interesting. I thought, gosh, how am I going to choose? And then listening to each voice, I knew immediately they'd only read a few words, and I just knew that is Heather, or that is Doug, or that is Katie. And it was amazing how quickly that happened.
Are you going to stick with writing thrillers, or is there another historical novel on the way?
So there is another historical novel almost written. I think there's about 90,000 words written of that, but it's not a book yet. And I've also nearly finished the second thriller, so kind of doing a bit of plate juggling.
Where do you find time to read then? I mean, that's a phenomenal work rate if you're working two books at a time.
I mean, at times I do feel like pretty much all I'm doing is writing and reading, but that isn't such a bad thing. No, I mean, I love reading. And as I say, I came to writing from reading. It always amazes me that there are some writers who say, you know, I can't read anything while I'm writing. And I respect that, and that's amazing. But actually, for me, I need to have this sort of clamour of different kind of voices in my head and need to be reading all sorts of different stuff, because otherwise I think it would get very boring.
I read something that you said, that it was reading that had fired your imagination, and as a young person in your 30s, it actually had given you some of the life experience that your tender years hadn't given you yet.
Absolutely, because I think there's that kind of age-old saying, write what you know. I think that was Hemingway who said it, maybe, might be wrong. But actually, as a kind of young person, 30-something, I don't have all that life experience. And actually, what I love about reading is that it takes me out of myself. It takes me out of my own small sphere and introduces me to all sorts of lives and experiences that I wouldn't have had. And you can absolutely do that as a writer. You just need to do your research.
And do you find it easy to write, or do you have to force yourself to your desk in the morning?
Oh, difficult. Depends on the day. I mean, literally, it's day by day. And some days, for whatever reason, I have a word count that I want to get to vaguely in my head. And some days I will get to that within a few hours. Other days I really, you know, I have to kind of chain myself to my desk, and it's much more difficult. I do think that the early part of writing a book, where you're just kind of, you're just getting stuck in and you're kind of writing and you don't really have the kind of pressure on yourself to make it into something. I think that's the most wonderful time. And then when you start kind of editing, that's where things get a lot more difficult and it feels more like work, but also very important.
So for our listeners who dream of becoming authors themselves, what would your one hint to them be?
I think it sounds really obvious, and it's probably almost too obvious, but I think just start writing, because that's almost what I have to tell myself every time I have an idea for a new book, because it can feel sort of so whole and perfect in your head that you almost don't want to blemish it by beginning the writing process, because as soon as you start writing, everything kind of seems to kind of start untangling, starts to tangle. But I think it's so important, and actually, you need to almost get into the habit of writing. So just getting some words down on the page every day is a really important thing, and it might feel really difficult at first. And when I read back, you know, I mean, I haven't read the back, but if I were to go back and read them, the things that I wrote at the very beginning, I would probably be really embarrassed. And I think it would be like reading an old diary or something. But I think it's a really important part of the process.
And I wondered also whether you feel that you have to know the ending of the book before you start writing. Certainly The Hunting Party starts with the disappearance that is at the heart of the book, but actually which forms pretty much the end of the book.
Absolutely. I think I found a real difference there between writing the historicals and the thriller, because I think probably with the historicals, I did have an idea of kind of beginning, middle and end, and vaguely how I would get there in between. But I think with the thriller, I realised from the very beginning, I needed to be much more structured in the way I was approaching it. Because I think with a murder mystery, plot is absolutely first and foremost. And if you don't have that kind of essential underpinning structure, you have a bit of a mess. So I did know how it was going to end. There were things that surprised me along the way. So twists that I hadn't kind of planned that I suddenly thought of as I started writing. And those are almost the most exciting things, I think, as a writer.
Yes, when the book starts to take you over a bit rather than the other way around, it's quite exciting, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Lucy Foley, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I look forward to speaking to you in the future about your next thriller and or historical novel.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
There's a different feeling this evening. Last night it was high spirits, a sense of camaraderie, togetherness. Tonight, the atmosphere carries a dangerous edge. It's as though that time out there, in all that wilderness, has put us on our guard. I wonder if the others can still see the deer, like me, buckling to her knees. It has become a dark thing between us, with the freighted quality of a guilty secret. We killed something together. We were all complicit, even if Emma was the one who took the shot. We did it for fun. Everyone, apart from me, seems to have fractured into their proper pairs, drawing back into their primary allegiances. Nick and Beau, Emma and Mark, Miranda snaking an arm around Julian's waist. At a little remove, Giles and Samira stand talking to each other in a low murmur. Miranda has persuaded them to leave Priya in the cabin tonight so we could all be grown-ups this evening. But judging by Samira's mutinous expression, she isn't exactly happy about it. There's some enforced jollity as Julian carries a bottle of champagne around, pouring liberally. But everyone seems to be gulping it down, hardly tasting it, as though they are trying to drink themselves into the spirit of things. Of course, perhaps I'm imagining this, projecting onto them a tension that really exists only in my own mind. But I'm not so sure, because I see the quick, animal-darting looks they are all giving one another. I am not alone in that. We are looking for something in each other's faces. But what is it? Familiarity? A reassuring reminder of all that holds us close? Or are we fearfully searching for some new element, glimpsed out there on that bleak mountainside? Something new and strange and violent.
The Hunting Party, written by Lucy Foley and narrated by a brilliant cast of narrators, is TB703876. And thanks to HarperCollins, all of Lucy Foley's books are available as talking books from the RNIB Library. And Lucy will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, we say farewell to June Whitfield and look back at her contribution to the RNIB library. But first, in 2017, Susie Kenaway asked her son Guy to help her to die. She was 88 years old and wanted to avoid sliding into geriatric catatonia. Guy immediately began taking notes. The resulting book, Time to Go, will be simultaneously published in hardback and audio next month. By turns, a manual for those considering assisted dying, a sympathetic description of old age, and a portrait of a mother-son relationship. The book offers a route map through the moral, legal, emotional, and practical maze of how to leave life on one's own terms. Its author joins me in the studio. Guy Kenaway, welcome to Read On.
Really, really good to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
I've given a brief synopsis, but can you give us a bit more background to the book, please?
Yes, the fact is that I have absolutely no interest in assisted dying whatsoever up until the moment that my mother said, will you please give me a hand? I don't want to either go into a care home or slip into dementia, and I want to take control over, you know, the place and the manner and the timing of my own death. And from the moment she said it to me, I thought, oh, this is quite an interesting subject, and I started taking notes. So I was learning about all of the implications from a standing start. And in that way, I think it was quite good, because I'm always a bit suspicious of experts. That sounds terrible, actually, after all the Brexit stuff. But I'm not just suspicious of all experts, but I'm no expert on the subject. So I learnt about it and started discovering things about my mother and me and the subject of death and life as I went along. And it took about a year.
And I had not appreciated how, even if an individual has clearly stated that they don't want to carry on beyond a certain point, there are so many difficulties thrown up in the way of achieving that.
Yes. Well, the thing is, Red, it is a very tricky subject, because, you know, it's an extremely heavy thing to do. It's a very heavy thing to do, to take your own life. And I think one of the really important things to say is that, for some reason, suicide is a word that covers all of the activity of taking your life. But I put suicide and assisted dying as very, very separate activities. And I think that suicide as a cause of, as a result of mental illness, or through mental illness, or through depression, or with young people, is absolutely not something that I, you know, in any way approve of. And it's a different subject, and not the subject of my book. But very old people who just can see a really horrible thing about to happen to them, who want to take control of it, is another subject altogether, and that's the subject of my book. But even when my mum said, "This is what I want to do, I want to get a plan, and we're going to do it," it was still like, oh my God, are we actually going to do this? This is like a really, really heavy thing to do, even if it's got everyone's approval.
Certainly it has a great degree of finality to it.
I mean, certainly. As my mother said to me, it's not something that you can practice doing.
Yes, even Brexit seems to be an easier thing to extricate yourself from. You use a very telling phrase, that life is too precious to be not lived properly, and that, like a relationship or a party or a job, you have to know when it's time to go. Your mother was absolutely adamant that there was going to be a point beyond which she did not want to stay at the party.
Yes. And she changed her mind quite often after that. And I completely understood that, although it was slightly confusing, because you're thinking this is about to happen, and then she would just draw back from it, which I think is obviously a totally legitimate thing to do. And I understood that. But the book really is, although it does have assisted dying and my relationship with my mother over that at the centre of the plot, it really is about the importance of living your life properly and valuing life highly enough that there's a line below which actually, you know, I don't want to live, which is definitely the case with me. That's definitely the case with me. After looking at my mum, and I've went to quite a lot of old people's homes, and I saw some people dying, in pretty tough, in very tough circumstances. And I did think, you know, that's not for me. I don't want to do that.
The product of that as well, though, is that the rather fractious relationship that you and your mother had hitherto had thawed quite a lot over the process of actually admitting that life has to be enjoyed whilst it can be.
Yes, well, the thing is that she said to me, Guy, I've come to this decision. I want to start planning this and talking about this, and will you help me? And although I was shocked at the beginning, after sort of about a day or two, I did remember that I'd been wanting to kill my mother for about half my life, because although she is an amazingly powerful and glorious human being, she's also one of the most annoying people on this planet, at least for her son. So I did think, oh, this is going to be absolutely marvellous. At the same time, obviously, of thinking this is going to be terrible. And just the activity of talking about it and planning about it and indeed joking about it, I think we got a bit of time to clear a few things up which needed to be spoken about, you know, which we'd never really covered.
Now, as you've indicated, it is also a funny and satirical look at the subject of assisted dying. Is it only through humour that you think that you can look at something as germane to life and death as assisted dying?
Well, I think to throw in a few jokes really does help, because it, as I said, it is an extremely heavy subject. But it was, it, you know, there were many, many hilarious moments. And I think that life is so tough that I have to always... The only defence against life is laughter, really. Otherwise, it's just... It becomes intolerable for me, and I do like to have a laugh. And I think what I found around old age, because she's 89 and my stepfather was 91, was that there's a lot of reverence about around old people, and about not being rude about them and not pointing things out were, like, to me, blaringly obvious. And I found that just talking about the annoying things of looking after old people, it was a good release for me. And I didn't think many other writers had really done that. Just basically take the piss out of old people, not to put too fine a point on it. At the same time, with a kind of underlying, I hope, a sort of undertow of love and affection. But, you know, the time that she would take to, you know, cross the room or to get in and get out of the car, all these little things that began to madden me, were very easy to make jokes about, And her repetitions, for instance, the way she'd tell me the same story again and again and again and again and again, which I found quite hilarious. But I guess maybe other people don't, but I did.
Well, I suppose also the fact that you do address these things in the book makes other people reading the book realise that it's not just them who's thinking these thoughts. It's not just their elderly relative who does things like that, and it is okay to voice those irritations.
Totally.
The press release actually says it's both a route map to those who are thinking of investigating assisted death and also a call to arms for action to be taken. Is that something you feel comfortable with?
Yes, well, you know, I can only really talk about my mum and me, and I'm not a political activist, I'm a writer. But the more I looked into it, the more I thought that something does need to be done about the law, because, and maybe actually about the media too, because one of the things I noticed was that the newspapers were very quick to pick up on stories like, you know, the nephew who poisons his grandpa in order to try and get the farm. And there are very, very few and far between, but they normally got some prominence in national media. But the many thousands of families who have a really old and totally decrepit and clapped out granny or grandpa or great granny and grandpa being kept alive by the NHS in a torturous manner, those people's plight are not being spoken about at all, and they're expected just to suffer in silence, both the poor person in the bed and the poor family around the bed, who are thinking, you know, how long can this go on for? We know where this is ending, and it's just painful and tortuous for us all. And those families' stories are not really being told very well, and if someone pipes up for them, a lot of people silence those voices by saying, you know, you maliciously want them to die for pecuniary reasons or for something like that. But I found none of that. I found very loving, caring children and grandchildren wanting the best for their parents or their grandparents and wanting some peace and the lack of pain. And not wanting them to die because it was convenient, because their being alive was inconvenient, or they were going to make some money out of it. Quite the reverse. They were doing it absolutely out of selfless motives. And their story's not really being told. And I definitely saw that a lot, and I wanted to tell that side of the story so people start seeing that it's not necessarily a malicious thing to say to someone, it's time to leave the party, or for me to say, it's time for me to go now, you know.
At points, I did wonder whether there was some kind of conspiracy being uncovered that the church, the law, the medical professionals and the big pharmaceutical companies and, as you say, the press, all wagging a finger in the face of the debate, when actually with our pets, we would make those decisions far more readily than we do with our human relations. Do you think there's a bit of a conspiracy going on?
You know, I thought it was going to be about the church when I started looking at it. I thought, where's everyone got this idea that we can't even discuss this? Forget, actually make the decision or make some legislation. It's really something that can't be detached. Then I felt maybe it was the doctors. But the doctor that I spoke to, a guy called Peter Christian, a lovely GP from North London, said to me that he really objected to being put in the role of facilitating someone's death. And he said he wasn't in principle against it, but he felt it wasn't his job as a doctor. And actually, I thought that was a very fair point. He said, I did not come into medicine to basically hasten the death, the departure of a whole load of my patients. Whether or not it was a good thing, he didn't think it was his role. And I could see him objecting to being placed in the role, because, to be honest, I wouldn't like to be placed in that role either. But it was really only when I saw one particular death, and I'm sure most people listening to this will have heard a similar story, which was it was long and drawn out and really torturous. This lovely old fellow, he's described in the book. And when I went to that room to sit with him and talk to him, and he was basically going, I really want to die, I really want to die. And then the door would fly open and in would come two lovely nurses, and they would plug him full of antibiotics and steroids and change all his dressings and, you know, give him more oxygen and just be like bringing him in the precise direction which he said he didn't want to go. And after a few days in that situation, Red, I really felt, with an unhappy wife there, with children wringing up, all of us were wringing our hands, and I was watching horrible pain, I thought, whose needs are really being met by this process? Because it was also very expensive, you know, it's a lot of medical care. And I looked around the room and saw all the dressings and all the medical appliances and the bed that went up and down and the amount of drugs that he was being given, and I thought, I tell you whose needs are being met here, and that's the needs of the pharmaceutical company, because it was costing in drugs and, as I say, in appliances and dressings and so forth, a lot of money that last week. And I started looking into that, and although it's a very disputed figure, and I'd be really interested, and I'd recommend all readers, not of my book, but of any book, who are listening to this now, to look into the costs of the last 6 months of our lives in Britain, the medical costs, because it looks like a huge amount of our costs are actually being spent, even in the last 6 weeks. It's hard to drill down and find out the precise percentage, because I think that the NHS and maybe the pharmaceutical companies, quite likely the pharmaceutical companies, don't want people to know, because there's a lot of profit there. And I feel that that money could be better spent on my grandchildren than on me as an old codger, you know, in the last, keeping me alive for another 3 weeks. I'd rather it was spent on my grandchild or my granddaughter, you know, on whatever, you know, on young people who've got a bit of a, there's a reason, you know, you're not just saving them for 3 weeks, basically. And I do think that that needs to be looked at and it needs to be talked about. And what I'd really like is someone much cleverer than me to really find that figure, because I could not find it. Or rather, every time I got it, someone disputed it. But they do say sometimes that 75% of our medical costs of our life are spent in the last 6 months of our lives. That's one that's come up, but it is a little bit disputed. But it's lopsided.
With so much debate over the funding of the NHS, changes are clearly going to have to be made in the way healthcare is funded in this country. Do you think one of those changes will be how we treat people in the final months of their lives then?
Yeah, it's a very hard argument to maintain for sort of pecuniary reasons, to go, you know, we should be knocking people off because it's a bit, it's a bit costly, they're costing us a bit much. And that is like a very difficult argument to make. Now, personally speaking, if I'm costing a quarter of a million pounds, not a quarter of a million, say, probably is, it's probably about £100,000 a year to keep going to, you know, for another 9 months in a situation where I don't recognise my daughter, I don't recognise my son, I don't know where I am, I'm in constant pain, I would say that £100,000 could be a lot better spent somewhere else, or almost on anywhere else. And I don't really want that money spent on me. I feel it's selfish. But other people may feel differently, and they may feel they paid their taxes and they're totally they deserve it. But it's more want to allow people to make a decision and for it to be accepted and understood and not vilified or challenged. You know, it's got so many echoes of so many other issues, which in my life I've seen. People being gay, which when I was young was illegal and very hidden. And when it came out and we all talked about it, everyone thought, oh, it's absolutely fine. What were we all making such a big fuss about? And now we're getting that with people's gender. I can see it's another debate, another debate going on. And I feel this is another subject that's very in the closet, that it's sort of going on secretly and privately. And it just needs to open it up and say, what is this last 6 months of a terribly difficult life? And with the advancement in medicine and in hospitalization and all that sort of stuff, we are living much longer than we ever thought we would. And I'm not saying that a really happy eighth decade isn't a wonderful thing, but a really nasty last 8 weeks, I've seen it now a number of times, and it's horrible.
I think some listeners will be concerned that other people's views of what disabled and healthy means and the short-term reactions that some of us can have to losing our sight, for instance, can actually, over a period of time, become less painful, and you can start realising that you can take more out of life than you thought you might be able to. How do we ensure against people changing their minds after they've embarked upon
after
a process?
Well, yes,
after they've embarked upon a process where they might have raised the hopes of theirs around those around them?
Well, it's fascinating to be in the RNIB building here, because it's obviously such an interesting case in point here. And I'm really glad to be talking about it with you. It's extremely tricky. It's extremely tricky. And I don't think anyone should pretend that it's not tricky. I guess the only person who can define the quality of your life is yourself. Just as people are self-identifying in gender or in sexuality, saying, this is who I am, this is where I am. But at the same time, I guess everyone would say, don't do it in a hurry. Have a good long think about this, because this is not a decision that you can take you can take again. And then you got added to that the difficulty of, like, as you get nearer and your mind begins to start crumbling and decisions get harder to make, you're in less and less of a position to make a responsible decision. So it's an incredibly complex thing. But I don't want to put my children through that horrible thing. And I guess I will have to decide. You shouldn't be killing yourself because of a disability. That is, you know, I just think that's a total red line. That's not what this is about. This is about knowing that life has been led properly, not that something awful's happened. I think that, well, talking for myself, I can imagine myself, Red, You know the way they have in their newspapers, they have forthcoming marriages and they have deaths and they have births. And I can imagine, won't be soon, but at some point there will be forthcoming deaths where I will say, you know, kids, on this day next year, I am going to die. That's the day that I've picked. So we'll plan around it and we will all know about it and we will say the things that we're going to say to each other and we will make, I don't know what, some kind of event, party. I don't know what it'll be. Maybe it'll be something very private. Maybe it won't be. And we'll plan around it and it'll be, everyone will be in the full knowledge, it will be out of the closet, that I have decided to leave the party on that day. So let's now, we've got that much time to have a, you know, to live my life. And certainly, most things I know are better when there is an end put in place, whether it's a poem or a song or a book. You know, a good ending is a really crucial part of most things. But we've forgotten this about our lives.
Time to Go by Guy Kenaway will be simultaneously published in hardback and audio on the 7th of February and available wherever you buy your books. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we hear the books of Lucy Foley's life, here's Robert Kirkwood.
At the end of last year, we at Read On were saddened to hear about the death of June Whitfield. She was a regular fixture on both television and radio for 6 decades, starring in Carry On films, Hancock's Half Hour, Last of the Summer Wine, Absolutely Fabulous, and even made an appearance in Friends. At the age of 92, she was made a dame in the 2017 Birthday Honours for her services to drama and entertainment. She's also the voice behind many great talking books, available commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. In 2001, she visited the studios in Camden to record this short story exclusively for RNIB. It's by the author Nina Bodden, and it tells the story of how she was commissioned to write a book starring a blind character.
Seeing in the Mind by Nina Bodden, read by June Whitfield. I have only once written a book, not to order exactly, but to please a particular audience, a girl of 7 who was, as she put it, a little bit blind. We'd gone on holiday with her family, friends who had children much the same age as ours, renting an old manse on the side of a loch on the Isle of Mull. Janie, that's the name I gave her in the book I wrote for her, was the youngest of 4 children. The elder 2 were perfectly sighted. The 3rd child, a boy, had been born with infantile glaucoma. He could see out of 1 eye, the other was glass. A useful prop for a boy with a mischievous nature. The first time I bathed him, along with my son the same age, I steeled myself to take his eye out and wash it, as I'd seen his mother do, intending to be absolutely casual about it as she was. But I was secretly terrified. And he knew it. He called my bluff. He took the eye out himself, hopped out of the bath and chased me round the bathroom with it. Serve me right. Janie had less sight than her brother. She could only see a little light and shade. One day the other children decided to climb to a particularly enticing cave they had spotted on the face of a cliff that was too steep for Janie, and for me too, since I was going through a vertiginous period. So she and I walked round the loch instead and talked about the old story the locals had told us about the lake horse, a great horse that was to be seen sometimes galloping on the surface of the loch, a greedy creature of mist and terror that took human souls to keep it company in the deep water. Janie and I decided that this was just a story to frighten children and keep them away from the dangerous loch. Then she sighed. "They won't let me do dangerous things," she said. She had wanted to climb to the cave with my children and her brothers and sister. She sighed again, and then she said, "I wish you'd write a book about a blind girl, Nina." "What sort of book?" she said very promptly. "A book about jewel thieves and caves, and a blind girl who does something brave. We discussed what a blind girl could do that was special, something a sighted person would find difficult. Then, that night, in the creaky old manse, we were given the answer. There was a storm, and all the lights in the house went out. We were an improvident lot, and had neglected to buy candles. Or perhaps they were provided, and we'd simply not seen them. The manse was full of crooked corridors and unexpected stairs. The only person who was able to find her way around, the necessary guide when one of us wanted to go to the lavatory, was 7 years old. "I can see how to go in my mind," Janey said. She could find her way in the dark. So, in my story, the children, Janey and her brother and Perdita, the witch's daughter, are abandoned by the wicked jewel thieves in a dark cave, and Janey leads them out to daylight and safety. The Witch's Daughter is a conventional adventure story, and I hope Janey enjoyed it. But writing it, trying to imagine what she could see in her mind, was the real adventure for me. Not alas for everyone. A couple of years ago, an American company made a film of the novel. I was well paid, but not consulted. This happens sometimes, and I was not particularly dismayed, merely interested to see what they had made of it. When I finally saw the film, I could hardly believe it. It was quite well done. My 13-year-old granddaughter caught her breath and sobbed in the right places. But they had left out the blind girl. No Janey. One of my grandsons said, "It was like making Hamlet without Hamlet." "I'm not Shakespeare," I said, but I took his point.
The late June Whitfield reading the words of Nina Bodden, and the book they were talking about is called The Witch's Daughter, and it's available from RNIB Talking Books. Also in the library, you'll find June Whitfield's autobiography, written and read by her. It's called And June Whitfield.
Yeah, well, an education like that must have cost them a fortune. But your real education started with me. And all it cost me was 30 bob for a bottle of gin. God, it was like striking oil in the North Sea. Plow!
Oh, you are coarse. It's no wonder my parents thought I'd married beneath me.
Nah, well, they should have got used to it by now. After all, you've given them three beautiful grandchildren. And talking of children, Susan should be there by now. She's probably on the sofa with some long-haired git who's nipped out from nipped round with a bottle of gin.
They're not all like you, you know. Anyway, Susie knows what she's doing.
Yeah, well, I want to know what she's doing too. Like mother, like daughter.
5 years after that first show, and several series later, we changed writers, and the Fletchers of Ealing became the Medfords of Purley. As no one on the production team could think of a suitable title for the new project, the BBC, in a sudden flash of inspiration, called it Terry and June. Well, it did us all right for another 8 years, and we ended up recording over 100 episodes.
Maybe he'll go away.
Well, of course he'll go away, with all our valuables.
Yeah.
Well?
Well, I'm thinking. Yes, yes, a dog would scare him away.
We haven't got a dog.
I know that, but, I mean, if the burglar heard a dog, it would scare him away.
I'll ask him to wait while you go out and buy one, shall I? What are you doing?
Oh, I'm impersonating a dog like that Percy Thrower bloke.
Percy Thrower? Percy Thrower talks about cucumbers and things.
Oh, I'll stick to a dog, yeah. He won't be scared if I stand around talking about cucumbers, will he? I don't know, though. Well, now, does this sound anything like a dog?
If it happens to have asthma, yes.
June Whitfield reading and June Whitfield, her autobiography, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now it's back to Lucy Foley for the books of her life. So, Lucy, was there a book that you read as a child or an adolescent that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes, this was such a difficult question because there were so many, but probably the book was The Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton. And my granny actually had an antiques shop, and so she had all these wonderfully antique editions of the Enid Blyton books. And I found that, and for me, it's what storytelling is. So, you know, there is a world in itself inside the tree, but there is a different world that kind of visits the tree every time the children climb up it. And in terms of world building, you know, she is an absolute master of that. And that really got me excited about the kind of possibilities of writing.
Once upon a time, there were three children, Joe, Beth and Franny. They lived with their mother and father in a little cottage deep in the country. They had to help their parents both in the house and in the garden, and there was lots to do. Now, one day, their mother had a letter. She didn't very often have letters, so the children wondered what it was about. "Listen," she said. "This is something quite exciting for you. Your cousin Rick is coming to stay with us." "Oh," said the children, pleased. Rick was about the same age as Joe. He was a happy boy, rather naughty, and it would be such fun to have him. "He can sleep with me in my little bedroom," said Joe. "Oh, Mother, what fun! When is he coming?" "Tomorrow," said Mother. "You can put up a little bed for him, and you must make room for Rick's things in your cupboard. He's going to stay quite a long time, because his mother is ill and can't look after him." The three children flew upstairs to get Joe's room ready for Rick as well. "Hey, what will Rick say when we tell him about the enchanted wood and the faraway tree?" cried Joe. "And what will he say when we show him our friends there, Silky and Moonface and the dear old saucepan man and everyone?" said Beth. "He will get a surprise," said Franny.
The Magic Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB15677, narrated by Evelyn McLean. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, probably perfect for a kind of wintry day would be And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. And I read this again while I was sort of thinking about writing my murder mystery, and I just think it's absolutely brilliant. For anyone that thinks Agatha Christie is cozy crime, read this book and it will change your mind, because it is really dark and really chilling and absolutely brilliant.
The three men started on their tour of the island. It proved unexpectedly simple. On the northwest side, towards the coast, the cliffs fell sheer to the sea below, their surface unbroken. On the rest of the island, there were no trees and very little cover. The three men worked carefully and methodically, beating up and down from the highest point to the water's edge, narrowly scanning the least irregularity in the rock which might point to the entrance to a cave. But there were no caves. They came at last, skirting the water's edge, to where General MacArthur sat looking out to sea. It was very peaceful here, with the lap of the waves breaking over the rocks. The old man sat very upright, his eyes fixed on the horizon. He paid no attention to the approach of the searchers. His oblivion of them made one at least faintly uncomfortable. Blore thought to himself, "'Tis unnatural. Looks as though he's gone into a trance or something." He cleared his throat and said in a would-be conversational tone, "Nice peaceful spot you've found for yourself, sir." The general frowned. He cast a quick look over his shoulder. He said,
"There is so little time. So little time. I really must insist that no one disturbs me."
Blore said genially, "We won't disturb you. We're just making a tour of the island, so to speak. Just wondered, you know, if someone might be hiding on it." The general frowned and said,
"You don't understand. You don't understand at all. Please, go away."
Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB701556. It's narrated by Dan Stevens.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, so I think the one that I read recently that really struck me was Belinda Bauer, Snap, and she was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, which is a real, I think, a first for a crime author. So that was really exciting. For anyone that thinks that crime is all plot and no character, read this book and that will change your mind, because it is phenomenal on character. The characters have stayed with me, but the plot is equally taut and brilliant, and I'm still thinking about it now.
It was so hot in the car that the seats smelled as though they were melting. Jack was in shorts, and every time he moved his legs, they sounded like sellotape. The windows were down, but no air moved. Only small bugs whirred, with a sound like dry paper. Overhead hung a single frayed cloud, while an invisible jet drew a chalky line across the bright blue sky. Sweat trickled down the back of Jack's neck, and he cracked open the door.
"Don't," said Joy. "Mum said stay."
"I am staying," he said, "just trying to get cool." It was a quiet afternoon, and there wasn't much traffic, but every time a car passed, the old Toyota shook a little. When a lorry passed, it shook a lot.
"Shut the door," said Joy.
Jack shut the door and made a tutting sound. Joy was a drama queen, 9 years old and always bursting into tears or song or laughter. She usually got her own way.
"How long now?" she whined.
Jack looked at his watch. He'd got it last birthday when he'd turned 11. He'd asked for a PlayStation.
20 minutes, he said.
That was a lie. It was nearly an hour since the car had coughed and jerked and rolled to a crunchy halt on the hard shoulder of the southbound M5 motorway. That made it over half an hour since their mother had left them here to walk to an emergency phone.
"Stay in the car. I won't be long."
Well, she was being long, and Jack got that niggle of irritation he always felt when his mother was not his father.
Snap by Belinda Bauer is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB24554, narrated by Andrew Wincott.
Lucy Foley, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.